I'm David W. Berner, and this is The Writer's Shed. We're recording on a day where there's a little rain in Chicago today, just a little bit of a drizzle. You can hear it tapping on the roof of the shed here. There's something really, what do you call that? I think the Irish call it a soft day, a fine soft day, right? It's comforting to hear that little bit of rain on the roof of the shed here today. So kind of like that. It's a good day to sit in and read, that's for sure. And maybe sit down and read something from 713 Books. 713 Books is an indie press, and we want to talk to its founder today. We are going to talk to its founder today. We've been wondering here at the Writer's Shed about indie presses, where they are these days. Of course, we know a lot about them. Anybody who is writing books these days or manuscripts, trying to get something published maybe for the first time or even the fourth, fifth, sixth time, indie presses are what's keeping the creative world alive in a lot of ways. The corporate world of publishing is a different animal and almost a different species when it comes to publishing. So we decided to talk to Leland Chuck of 713 Books about what it means to be an indie publisher these days and maybe what we should do next to make things even better for the world of writers and publishing. So Leland, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate that. You got to ask, what makes someone decide they're going to jump into the world of the independent press when the publishing world is kind of in the Wild West right now?
Yeah, no, we've been doing it for about 6 years. And, my story is that, I published my first couple of books with small presses. And I obviously, like a lot of writers, wanted to publish a book for many, many years, thought I'd be published at 30, and then, kind of 35 rolls around, 37, It's not happening. I've been writing probably since college, I've had agents and close calls and et cetera, et cetera. And sure. It looked like it just wasn't going to happen. And I was, I was at a residency when I was diagnosed with a blood cancer. A rare form of myelodysplastic syndrome, kind of like leukemia related, and needed a bone marrow transplant.
Goodness.
So 2013, 2014, I ended up getting the I'm very lucky, ended up getting the transplant in July 2014. I was in the hospital. It's July 13th. It's the date of, they give you the stem cells and a syringe into your port. And there's like several days where you just watch your blood counts drop. And while you're waiting for your stem cells to kind of get where they're supposed to go and then start growing new bone marrow again, and which is what produces new healthy blood cells. And it's July 13th and the doctor comes in and says, it looks like your counts are going up again. So it looks like the transplant is successful, obviously long road ahead, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's engrafted. It's working like it's supposed to. And right after the doctor leaves the isolation ward, I check my email and there's the small press in Chicago. Jason Pettis's Chicago Center of Literature and Photography. They took my first novel and,
an interesting day, to put it lightly.
Right. Very memorable. I was like, oh, well, there's no advance, right? Small press.
Sure.
Not what you imagine, your big, debut to be, but
right.
At that time it felt like the greatest thing in the world, obviously.
That's sure.
I would be living and this dream, this lifelong dream, would come true. And then 2 years later, after the book had debuted, another small press took my story collection on that same day. It's 2 years after the transplant date, my new birthday, right? So after two books, I was like, okay, there's something here. And I'd always wanted to create some sort of writing community or literary magazine of some sort, because just a DIY by nature. Okay, and I thought, let's start a press. Let's start a press so that other writers that are trying to get their first books published don't have to freaking wait until you're their deathbed to like have some publisher, you know, validate their work. I mean,
yeah,
it's just a stupid book, right? So that's the story behind 713 Books. And now we're, you know, we just published today our 23rd book, and there'll be 25 by the end of the year. We do 4 or 5 books a year, and probably like 80% of them are first books, like first books of fiction, first books of short stories.
Well, not only is that a harrowing story in a lot of ways, but it's got to be rewarding for you to not only, you know, finally get your, well, get your life back and also get your first book out there, but also to help others. I mean, to kind of bring others into the fold here where you've, where we've all at somewhere down the line have struggled to get to.
Right. And I, you know, I go back to how a transplant works, which is a stranger. You know, I didn't get a transplant from a family match or anything like that, but a stranger has to, you know, basically get their stem cells harvested for you. And then, you know, they basically give another stranger life. And it's very similar to what a publisher does, right? We're kind of unsung heroes, you know, in that way, and that publisher has to actually like put money down for this and do all the work, you know, for a writer to get appreciated and find an audience and all that. So it's just, again, it's usually a stranger, right? I didn't know Jason Pettis, you know, before. He saw something in the work, and it's been super gratifying to be able to do that for other people.
Yeah, that's amazing. So in the 20 or so books that you've published now, what have you found? What have you discovered about this process, especially in the world that we live in now with publishing the way it is?
You know, it's challenging. I think for a small press, obviously you're the underdog, and you're the underdog at every part of the process, from even, you know, distribution, which is kind of the higher level business thing, right? Just being able to sign with a national distributor means that you probably have to publish a lot of books and make a fair amount of money to even get to that point. We've tried a distributor, you know, before, and it becomes very expensive for the publisher. So it's actually easier and more flexible to do the on-demand, print on-demand model, but that comes with downsides too, because of exposure to the bookstores and there's some publicity issues, and like the whole system is very like kind of a Frankenstein, you know, in terms of like all the,
it's archaic in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And not only that, it seems, you know, we've all talked about for many years now, those of us who do this kind of work one way or the other, have talked about the gatekeepers of the world, the you know, and it feels like in a lot of ways, people like you and the growth of indie presses over the years are kind of, you know, in a way, giving their finger to the gatekeepers in a way. And I applaud that. I mean, I think that's wonderful. Do you feel like that's what you're doing in a way?
Initially, certainly that was a motive. You know, it's very open on the website, like about my story of how I became published and the various close calls that I've had and the way the publishing industry works and how it's becoming increasingly, I don't know, maybe it's been unequal, like for all of time, but it seems to be increasingly devoted to the books that get the big 6-figure, 7-figure advances. You know, the ones that are going to become movies, you know, and those books that are big money books, you know, pay for the industry, pay for the literary fiction books, the novels, that the mid-list author that doesn't make a lot of money. So
yeah,
the scale of it is
no question about that. Yeah, it's right. So you know, I've said before that, you know, some, you know, great iconic cultural books of our time, if they were brought to publishers today, probably wouldn't get published by some of the big publishers. I mean, I'm thinking of something like, you know, Kerouac's On the Road. I can't imagine that someone taking that today and going, okay, we'll give it a chance. I can't see that happening.
Right.
But indie publishers like you might do that.
Yeah. And I think like what used to be the big publishing ethos of kind of eschewing business and being more about being a literary tastemaker, you know, the whole like Max Perkins, you know, as an editor editing a million page books, like that whole ethos is
right.
pretty much gone away.
Yeah,
it's become very, very corporate, machine like, and you know, all the big publishers are part of even larger corporations, right? Because
right.
they're not capitalist enough to grow, you know, the 5%, 10%, 20%, you need to like attract market attention. So you're part of these much larger machines. And it feels like at some point, you know, all the big houses are probably going to be owned by Disney or Fox.
Yeah, I don't know. And the thing of it is that they can't, in this marketplace, in this sort of model out there, they need to have those big movies and those big gigantic books to stay alive. Otherwise, they're not going to stay alive.
Right.
I mean, at least that's my take from my end of the world. Right. And you know, it's changed the model creatively. It's it's become difficult for those on the creative side, and not the marketing or the editorial or the business side to find a way in. But indie presses have done well. They've found their niches. Some have, you know, have died on the vine. It doesn't sound like you are. I mean, once you get past that third or fourth year, I think you're starting to make some headway and you're starting to make an impact. Would you say that? Is that where you feel you are?
I think like we've been lucky in that a lot of our books have been reviewed by the trades and have been reviewed by major outlets. One of our recent books got reviewed in the LA Times and NPR, and just critically, I think it's gone better than expected. You know, sales have been, you know, our numbers would pale, like be ridiculous, microscopic in comparison to even like the smallest large house, right?
Sure.
So I think in terms of like just reaching the raw number of people, I think it's going to be tough for any small press to do it. But I think I'm happy with the critical response to the books. And I think that it gives our authors a chance to kind of, you know, go and hopefully do big and better things and become, you know, that big house author down the road. I have no doubt that somebody is going to come out of our bunch and make that happen.
Well, that's wonderful that you believe that. And we have to have people like you who believe that. Tell me a little bit about the press itself. So why 713? What is it? Where does that come from?
713 was the date of the transplant, right? It's July 13th.
Okay, yeah. Okay, now right. I get the connection. Sure.
Right. 7.13.
Yeah.
And so it's like it's my second birthday. It's the book birthday for a lot of our first time authors, or all of our first time authors. And you know, I wanted the name to mean something. You know, I could have just called it Leland Books or something like that, but nobody would care. And I credit my wife for steering me off that path. She's just like, I was like gonna call it L Books at one point. She's like, why? Who cares? Like, nobody cares.
I like the idea of 713 because it gets people like me to ask the question, and then it becomes a real story, right?
Right. It is a story. It, you know, told it a few times. It's weird now, like 8 years after, you know, the transplant, to be still talking about cancer. And like, you know, I go to AWP and people will leave me their cancer memoirs or make pitches about cancer memoirs at the table and stuff, you know, which is great. I mean, it's great to be able to, you know, share my story with others, but also weird that people know so much about, you know, my medical history.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what do you look for? What does your press look for? What sparks your interest when you see a manuscript come your way?
You know, we look for genre bending stuff. I think we definitely look for literary fiction, adults, no young adults. We rarely take historical fiction. You know, an example I always say of a book that's just like I had to have was Kansas Stand by Farouk Ahmed. You know, basically very hard to categorize, right? It's like historical steampunk. It's just based in this fictive alternate reality where Kansas is a Muslim state and they're fighting a war against Missouri, which is a Christian state. And that's like the base around the Civil War times. And it's told from the perspective of a goat herder who's stuck in a minaret in a mosque in Kansas. It's just totally bizarre, right?
Wow.
That's the type of book that I'm like, okay, we got to have that. You know, Jackson Bliss just had a book come out, Amnesia of June Bugs. Basically is like tells the story around Hurricane Sandy in New York from the perspective of four or five different young people of different ethnicities as they try to find love, but the city's shut down and blacked out and they're stuck in a subway together. But they don't know each other for the most part. Yeah, it's a, you know, these interesting offbeat stories is kind of what I look for. Definitely not, you know, what a large press would publish, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, the word gets overused sometimes with the word quirky in a way, but also it's not your typical narrative. And that sounds like what sparks you. I think that would be the thing that when you read it, you're like, oh, okay, this is making me think. This is making me consider story in a different way.
Right. But, you know, as an editorial and a reader for fun, you know, you definitely have biases, right? I probably over-index. I've had several campus novels, for instance. I really enjoy reading campus novels of various types. We're publishing a campus novel next year. It's set in a fictive art school. You know, we've done several of those. We've published a lot of books that are set in the Bay Area, where I'm originally from. So I try to like check myself and be like, okay, I've done too many of these because I have this like these fetishes for these specific topics. But in general, you know, books that are, you know, that I can imagine being in a book that should be in a bookstore that would interest me if I went to a bookstore and a book like that came out from a big press. But increasingly, I cannot find those books, you know, from big presses.
That's interesting because, you know, you hear the phrase he added sometimes of, you know, if you're going to be a writer, write what you want to read, write the kind of story you want to read. Do you think it sounds like that's what you're doing when you're looking at submissions. You're looking at things that you want to read that you personally would find interesting.
Yeah. And then the more you read, and you know, I'm middle-aged now, and you just some books just don't interest you as they would if you were reading them from the perspective of when you were 25, right?
Right.
Coming of age, like I've read millions of coming of age novels, you know, people, you know, it's kind of Sex and the City type of books. I loved them back in the day, but don't love them anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm open to, you know, embracing my tastes as I age as well, in terms of like, I want to see something new, something I haven't read before. And the longer that you're alive, the more you've seen, the more you've read, and the more you've like, okay, this is like that, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to be able to say, okay, this is like that.
So let me ask you two questions here. One is, and they're very similar questions. One is what's wrong with the publishing world right now? Maybe that's a whole other podcast, but you know what I mean? But what would you say is, if there were like one thing, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but
yeah,
one thing that you would say, God, I wish we could do that differently, what would that be?
Well, it's an industry that probably shouldn't be beholden to capitalism, right? It should, like in, you know, European countries, they fund the arts. You know, and like Scandinavian countries, like let's take the Danish writer Dorothea Nors, right? She's, you know, lives in Copenhagen, I think. And, you know, she is like a nationally recognized, you know, author there that they exported, you know, to the US, you know, and it's all funded, you know, by the government. And there's a reason why you see so many translated South Korean novels now, like The Vegetarian and so on. It's because the government backs it, and that's they're exporting their culture.
And not only that, but they see the value for our society, for our culture. Exactly. And we are so, God, I couldn't agree with you more on this. We are so driven by the dollar in this industry, in every industry for that matter.
Right.
That it's hard to get art just to be art. Art has to be corporate.
Exactly. And, you know, there are obviously trappings to if art gets funded, like kind of nationalized, you know, you wonder about, you know, various interests getting involved there. But
yeah.
You know, think about the NEA and how much they get funded compared to like our military. And it's like, it's bonkers, right?
Right.
Like if we had like a fraction of our tank budget or whatever, you know, so many hundreds, thousands of artists would be supported. You know, and they would be able to do their arts without having to worry about, you know, making movies or selling a book that becomes a movie. You know,
yeah, right. So on the flip side of that, what's right with publishing right now?
I mean, I think everyone, people like to carp on New York people. And I lived in New York for, you know, 11 years and was one of those people, and the New York people in the publishing industry. And it's it's unfair in that many of them are unpaid, or not unpaid, but underpaid. Compared to, they could easily like go to law school and become a lawyer, but they chose to work in the publishing industry because they love books. And it's unfortunate that there's this huge capitalist machine behind it, but at the core, it's young people going into the industry at low wages, and they love books. And you know, agents and all the whole ecosystem powered by people who really care about books, and a whole new generation of people as well. So it's, I think that's what's working, is that there are these people passionate about it. We just need a better system so that they can actually, you know, thrive and work in the book industry for a long time. You know, like I think pre-generations of editors, there are also like a whole lot of editors that are dying at their desks because they've been in the business so long. Mm-hmm. Hard to imagine that being the case for a lot of the younger editors now, because of all the consolidation in the industry and because of all the capitalistic forces, like where they're just not getting paid enough and overworked and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, with that in mind, with the good and the bad, what's next for 713, 713? What do you hope will be the next thing for you?
You know, I would love to, I'm going to keep publishing kind of the same number of books, roughly 2 to 5 a year, for the foreseeable future. I think I would love to make sure that it lives beyond me. I think I've worked on almost all the books. So we brought on a co-editor who's worked on a couple of books, and I've had guest editors, you know, work on a couple of the books as well. I've done probably like 85% of the books myself. And I'd like to make it more open source, bring more voices in, more editorial heads in instead of myself. And hopefully, you know, probably in the next few years, kind of look into going 501c3 and you know, making sure that it's not just all about me, all about the money that I put into it, and more about like other voices coming in, other younger voices as well, to drive the press.
Well, it sounds like we need more people who think like you. Maybe if we get a whole bunch of people thinking like you, and those young editors in New York who aren't making enough money decide, maybe I can make not enough money someplace better.
Yeah.
The chance to do this kind of work, the opportunity to do this kind of work, is a lot easier now in terms of like how you actually do it, the nuts and bolts, yeah, than it used to be. So why not? You know, I'd love to see more people create indie presses and at least give it a shot and open the world up to some of the things we just talked about.
Absolutely. I was asked at a publishing panel recently, last week at the Pasadena Book Fest. It's like, are you for profit or nonprofit? I said, I'm for break even.
I had a feeling you might say that. Well, Leland, it's been a delight talking to you. I appreciate your time today. Your story is remarkable, and I wish you a lot of luck.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
It's easy to find 713 books on the internet. We urge you to look it up, and we urge you to submit if you feel like you might fit into their stable of authors and stable of book ideas. Leland Chuck, we thank you again for being part of the Writer Shed podcast this week. This has been episode 34 of the Writer Shed podcast. I'm David W. Berner. Our music is from iRay Music. Production and interviews is always produced right here in the Shed. You can find out more about Writer Shed Press at writershedpress.com and at the Writer Shed on Medium. You can also sign up for our newsletter there and find us at Writer Shed Press on Twitter. And want to remind you that we are still taking submissions for our one book that we're going to publish this year at Writer Shed Press. And you can find out all about that at writershedpress.com. The Writer Shed, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.